okay, read my print.
Well, we were listening to you, so wondering what the noise was. Okay, counsel, you have 50 minutes. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
If it please, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
It's fine. Go ahead, counsel, when you're ready.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Meyer. I was trial counsel, court appointed for Ms. Candace Gossett Manica. We're appealing her jury conviction at the Powhatan Circuit Court. She was charged with and convicted of perjury. We raised four assignments of error, two of which related to motion to strike or new notions of strike, a motion to set aside the verdict, and another for not allowing jury instruction in the favor of Ms. Manica. At issue here are two statements that were made by Ms. Manica. Ms. Manica testified at the burglary trial for David Gray, and she made two statements. She said on a Friday night she went to an MMA event with the defendant. And then she said approximately 7 days, about a week and a half later on September 20th, she took the defendant to pick up a gym bag containing shoes. Conversely, the defendant and another witness testified that Mr. Gray fought in an MMA event, and as in the fight, he was injured so badly he was laid out for a week. Well, subsequently, Mr. Gray pled guilty to a set of burglaries in Cumberland County that occurred over the same weekend. And because of those two statements, that's why we're here today. We're here today primarily because the two witness rule wasn't satisfied. And the two witness rule is well established over 200 years of jurisprudence, where to overcome the oath of another, you need at least two witnesses or strong corroborating evidence. I'd submit to this court that in the briefs, the Commonwealth's arguments bolster our contention that there wasn't strong corroborating evidence because you had to make inferences. The Commonwealth relies on the typical cases, Donati, Fritter, Schwartz, and we rely on them too. And there's strong policies for this two-witness rule. And the policy is to prevent a witness from being oppressed if they offer testimony that one party doesn't like, then being charged with perjury. And there's an important standard that's in the federal courts that requires that the questioner has the burden to elicit specific testimony. And that didn't happen in this case. And because the questioner at the original trial didn't elicit specific testimony from my client, she's charged with saying, hey, we went to a fight, and I went about a week and a half later to pick up shoes. The corroborating evidence in this case, and at trial, only one witness was called, David Gray himself. And the corroborating evidence consists of a stipulation from the fight promoter that said David Gray didn't fight that night. That's outstanding, because that's not what my client testified to. And that's what David Gray and another witness testified to, that he fought. My client just said, hey, we just went. So that does not corroborate Mr. Gray's testimony. The remainder of the corroborating evidence consisted of a plea agreement and a sentencing order from Powhatan and Cumberland, respectively. And what's really important is where that corroborating evidence emanated from. The sentencing orders and the plea agreement emanated from Mr. Gray. The fact that there's a heading and it's entered by the judge, it's an acknowledgement and it's an admission by Mr. Gray.
Counsel, would it have made a difference if those orders were based on not a guilty plea but a trial where he was convicted of those offenses by a jury?
Yes, it would. Not as much, But since they were admissions, essentially what that is it really doesn't corroborate the fact that my client said, we went to the fight, and then I went to pick him up a week later. It doesn't corroborate that those statements were false. What it corroborates is David Gray committed a burglary. So and if they were trials, and I think we'd have more of a relevancy problem than we did here, because then we're asking to make an even greater jump and an even greater inference, because then we're going to say, well, this group of people decided A, so therefore C must be true in this case. So I would say there would be a big difference. But at any rate, that's not what we're looking at here. Here, Mr. Gray said, I admit it, I agree, I'll sign. So this is really an extension of his testimony in this case. And it has to actually touch what my client said, and that's not the case here. And the case law supports me, and certainly the case law that the Commonwealth cites, Varner, which states that the corroborating evidence has to be independent, and it can't come from the mouth of the defendant, and it has to confirm the facts and the particulars of the case, and that's not the case here. To be candid with the court, I'm not sure if this is properly in the record, but it was argued by the Commonwealth that it would be illogical to presume otherwise that my client committed perjury. At David Gray's trial, in that transcript, it's in the record but was not introduced into evidence at my trial, the Commonwealth conceded that my client's testimony was immaterial. Now, whether or not we can hang our hat on that here, I'm hoping. but if not, at the second motion to strike, the judge conceded this isn't the strongest corroborating evidence, but still upheld the jury verdict. And again, because this is not a sentencing order from a trial, this is a continuing narrative. So we have Mr. Gray testifying at my client's trial that he would say anything to get out of trouble.
If I understand your position,
yes, sir.
Although that the law, for going back to Blackstone, has recognized that we will give more credibility to a statement against one's penal interest for all kinds of reasons. It's hard to imagine a guilty plea, anything being stronger against your penal interest than a guilty plea. The law may presume that he's telling the truth because he's exposed himself to jeopardy for it. It's still just him, and that does not provide a second witness.
Well, that's a bad comparison, because we're going to take the principles for hearsay, a statement against interest, and then apply that to a 200-year standard that we need two witnesses or strong corroborating evidence.
My question was friendly.
What's that?
My question was friendly.
Well... It's still the one witness, is my point.
That was my question, yes.
Yes, it's still, okay, I apologize.
I think you misunderstood.
I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. I apologize. But yes, it is one witness.
It's easy to misunderstand him when he's being friendly.
I don't have a lot of experience with it. I'm trying it out.
I apologize. But that's precisely what brings us here. And, we should look at Varner. We should look at Massey v. Commonwealth when we're looking at the corroboration. The corroborative evidence is that it does not emanate from his mouth, and it doesn't, as Judge Russell, as I see the light, and it doesn't rely on the defendant's, on that person's credibility. And in this case, those sentencing orders clearly rely on the witness's credibility, because he's the one that admitted he entered into the agreement, he admits this, and he pled guilty. So we're using the government documents, but we have to concede that they're reliable, and they have to concede they come from somewhere else, and we don't necessarily do that. And we have to concede that it doesn't rely on that witness's credibility. and everything stems from that. And again, the stipulation by the fight promoter doesn't corroborate anything because my client never testified that David Gray actually fought. She merely testified, we went there that night. Nobody asked a follow-up question. Did he fight? Well, I don't know what she would answer. But again,
so what's your interpretation of had you seen him fight before?
She saw him fight before.
Prior to September.
And therein lies the trap. Because now we can infer because she said that, she meant this. And keep in mind, the rule was invoked. My client was not in the courtroom, nor were any other witnesses during that trial. So she did not have the benefit, for the lack of a better term, of hearing the testimony. And so that's a problem for the questioner. So in essence, if we allow that and we allow that inference, we can allow the Commonwealth to set people up, or defense counsel to set people up for perjury by merely trying to craft questions and then tie it in three or four witnesses later. And I don't believe that would be proper in this case. And that's well established by Bronson v. U.S. That cited U.S. v. Stoltzky, Galano v. United States, and United States Colbert. And Bronson continues to say, quote, precise questioning is imperative as a predicate for perjury. And in the last 30 seconds, I'll address the final assignment of error relating to the jury instructions. Most of the argument was pretty well laid out and brief.
Let me just ask you to respond to the Commonwealth's. Was it preserved?
It was preserved.
How?
Because it was discussed in the record. And it was denied. And this isn't a case where there's four or five jury instructions on that point. There's only two. And it's kind of a legal fiction argument that it doesn't exist. And I think this court's ruling in Herring bolsters our point, the appellant's point, on that matter. There's notice that this is what we were arguing. This is what was argued.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Martin, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, Captain Ann Martin for the Commonwealth. And I'd just like to make an observation that has nothing to do with this case, and that is that if the people on the court want cake, you should talk to Judge Ducker's mother. Because she makes wonderful cake.
They already have.
Very good. Okay.
I'm not partaking in it, though. I just heard about it.
They're in the cake mood, that's why.
Okay. With regard to this case, the Commonwealth would ask that the conviction be affirmed because the evidence was sufficient to prove perjury by the defendant, and the second issue, the court did not err with regard to the jury instruction. With the
I'm going to try my friendly question a little hostily this time. I concede that for as long as there's been the two witness rule, there's also been a presumption that we add credibility to a person's statement against his penal interest. And so while it makes sense that he must be telling the truth because he's putting himself in jeopardy by pleading guilty to this offense, isn't that still just him as the witness, and that the conviction itself adds nothing to it as far as the second witness?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it would be... It is more than just him, because when he entered his guilty plea to the perjury charge in Powhatan, you know, the trial court, and we don't have really that transcript or anything, but the trial court would have heard some evidence, would have done the plea colloquy, and so the court would have made a determination. So it's not just the defendant
saying something, but is there any reason to believe that that colloquy wouldn't have been based on what the appellant, he said? I'm pleading guilty and I acknowledge that the facts are sufficient because I lied in my trial.
Right, but the trial court still accepted that. You know, if the trial court had some doubt about that, you know, they might have done something different. But the court still accepted that, and so we do have those orders. We also have.
How do we infer though that whatever happened during the course of the colloquy and a recitation of the summary of the evidence had anything to do with the defendant in this case?
Well, the point here, I think, Your Honor, is that what we're looking at, the purpose of the two witness rule or one witness in corroboration is that you're trying to figure out, you know, like in the Schwartz case, that 1876 case, that which version of the testimony was false, or in the Keffer case, was it the wife's testimony that was false about her husband driving, or the sheriff's testimony that he was or was not driving? And so the question here is, was Gray telling the truth? And because if Gray is telling the truth that he did commit these offenses and he lied at his burglary trial in Powhatan, then his alibi was false, and the witnesses who were corroborating his alibi were also giving false testimony.
Well, what portion of his alibi was false, though? That he was hurt, that he fought, that he stayed at the other gentleman's house for a week? If any of those things are the falsity that he pled guilty to, how does that implicate her?
Well, the falsity was that he did not fight on September 15th. He did not hurt his knee on that day. And he wasn't staying at somebody else's house, so that 5 days later, she took him from that house to another house to get his shoes.
But how did the orders prove that, or support that, or corroborate that?
Well, in the Cumberland case, the offenses happened at during this same weekend, and one of a print that matched the Gray's shoe, this tennis shoe, was found at one of the businesses in Powhatan, and there was also it was also found in Cumberland, but the Cumberland match was not as definitive as the match in Powhatan. And the thing about the shoes was that Gray was trying to say, well, I hurt my knee and I was laid up, so I wasn't walking around doing anything, and I wasn't wearing these shoes, and I didn't get them until 5 days later. So if the shoe print is there, somebody else was using my shoes. That was his theory at his burglary trial. And so for this defendant in this case to say, well, I took him to get his shoes, and she identified the shoes at his burglary trial as these are, I'm 99% sure that these are the shoes that we picked up. You know, it all goes to corroborating his alibi, which went to his guilt or innocence. And I would,
well,
I'd like
they're,
to...
But they're just inferences, aren't they? Based on her testimony, you're just inferring that they go to his alibi. But you listed the three things. Number one, that he fought. Did she testify that he fought?
She did not say directly he fought on that day. She said they went to the fight and that she had seen him fight before.
Okay. Number two, that he was injured. Did she testify that he was injured?
I don't believe that she testified to that, no.
And then number three, that he stayed at someone's house for a week. Did she testify that he stayed at someone's house for a week, or just that they picked up shoes from that person's house in a bag?
She testified that she picked him up from a person's house on Riverside Drive, and that was the other person who had testified at the burglary trial.
Asked whether or not her knowledge was that bag had been there because he'd been staying there for the week,
well,
or that the bag had just been left there the day before or the day of?
Well, she testified that they went from Sheets' house to this other person's house, to Wickline's house, and that that's where they got the shoes.
Okay, but was her knowledge tested about how long the bag or the shoes had been there, or whether he had been staying there, or whether he had been injured, or whether he fought?
I don't know that she was specifically testified about that, but in the whole trial, as it built upon the other evidence, there had been other evidence that talked about how long Gray had been at Sheets' house and where he'd been staying. And so her evidence was not like 1, 2, 3 matched up, but it was relevant to sort of establishing that he did have an alibi. And
she only bolstered the alibi by inference, correct? Not by direct testimony. But those inferences are being used against her to convict her for perjury.
Well, I'd just like to point out that at Grace...
Am I fairly summing things up or not?
Well, I think in some respects, yes, Your Honor. But I think that at Gray's burglary trial, since the defendant brought up what the Commonwealth said, I'd like to point out that at Gray's trial, Gray argued that Miss Manica's testimony corroborated his presence at the fight. So, I mean, he was using that as you know, they used it as corroboration at that point.
But if the fight ended by 10 p.m., as I believe the flyer said, and
yes,
there was some stipulation with the promoter, how does that corroborate his alibi if the break-in occurred after 10 p.m.?
Because what he said was that he went to this fight and he hurt his knee and he wasn't able to walk around. So he couldn't
but
be walking around.
But she didn't say that.
She did not say that, but that's what he said.
She separated at the time he testifies to that and is not privy to his testimony about that. So how do we take... infer that what she testifies is given his knowledge and what he testifies to?
Well, if his alibi is, I went to this fight, I hurt my knee, I can't walk, and she testifies that, yes, I did go with him to this fight, and then the business about the shoes, if he didn't fight, he didn't hurt his knee, and then he was able to walk around.
Ms. Martin, I can see the argument that her trial testimony and his trial corroborated at least part of his alibi. For him to have fought at the Hat Factory in Richmond and have been injured at the Hat Factory in Richmond on that day, he had to be there.
Right.
Her testimony puts him there.
There, yes.
So there it corroborates that portion of his alibi.
Yes.
But the remainder of his alibi about that he was laid up for a week and therefore couldn't be doing this, he couldn't be walking around in his shoes, nothing she said matches up other than he had the opportunity to have been hurt because he was actually physically there. If that's what he pled guilty to, lying about being hurt, being laid up at the other gentleman's house for a week when he wasn't actually there for the full week, he was only there on the one day, he may have only been there one day instead of laid up, how is anything after that demonstrate that what she said was false?
Well, what he testified to at her perjury trial was that none of those things happened on September 15th, that they had happened earlier in July or August.
And so that gets you one witness versus one witness. And so the question is, what's the second thing that moves the ball? And so if it's the fact of the conviction, what was the fact of his perjury conviction, what's the specifics of the finding of perjury in that case?
In his perjury case...
Was it that he was there at all, or was it that he wasn't laid up?
It was the whole thing. I think
well,
you
know, how do we know that?
That from the order?
Well, I mean, we have the order where he's found guilty of perjury. We have his testifying at Manica's trial about how he had lied at that point. And we have the fact that, you know, why would he say that he lied? Why would he say he committed perjury?
I mean, that makes no sense. I agree for all the reasons I said that we think that statement is inherently credible because he's exposing himself to penal interest, but that will coexist with the two witness or corroboration rule.
Well, I know that we've got this two witness rule. We've had it for a long time.
As long as we've had the presumption that somebody wouldn't lie about penal
But the statute itself doesn't really call for two witnesses. And so the corroboration doesn't have to be as strong as an actual second witness. It just has to be enough to overcome the defendant's presumption of innocence as to whether or not she...
That's a pretty big burden.
Well, but it's...
That's the bedrock of the criminal justice system.
But I think we have to look at the whole thing. And, you know, all the testimony, you know, what she said, how it all fit together. And certainly there is, if you look at some of the other cases, like the Donati case, that's the one where the guy was on the videotape. And he said, well, I'm on the videotape, but I'm really not masturbating. But the tape showed that he was. And so we really only had one witness. We had the tape, but it was enough.
And very direct.
Yes.
Not only enough, but very direct.
Yes. And in the Fritter case, that's the one where the guy said, well, I didn't get this letter, but then he had given the letter to the investigating police officer, and somebody else said, well, I wrote the letter, and the letter had his name on it. And so we have, you know, a lot of things that all sort of tie together. And that's really what we have here. If we look at, you know, what Gray said, how he testified, we look at the fact that he'd been prosecuted for perjury and for inducing perjury for other people. Well, the two people that testified at his trial were this woman in this case and this David Sheets guy. And so if he's pleading guilty to these things for inducing perjury, it's logical that this woman committed perjury when she testified, and that that's why the evidence would be sufficient to support that.
Is there anything in the record to say that he pled guilty to inducing her to commit perjury as opposed to the other guy?
Well, it's two witnesses. I mean, there were two charges of inducing perjury, and there were two witnesses.
Is there any that identifies her as one?
No, there is not. There is not. But again...
And we don't have the colloquy or any of that in the record.
No, we do not have any of that in the record. But again, we have to just use some common sense here. That's kind of what it comes down to. I've got just a couple minutes left. I'd like to briefly talk about the jury instruction, if I might. And first of all, you know, it's the Commonwealth's position that the defendant did waive this issue. He objected to the language of the Commonwealth's instruction that the Commonwealth offered. And the trial court overruled his objection on that. But the instruction that the defendant offered is not really clearly identified in the record. It's on page 2 of the appendix. It's not marked as refused or withdrawn or anything like that. The court then gave the proposed instruction that the defendant had on corroboration. But in all of that discussion in the transcript, it's appendix pages 390, 396, there isn't really anything to show that the defendant said, this is my instruction, this is what you should give, and the trial court said, refused. You know, all of the discussion was about the Commonwealth's instruction, and the defendant's objection to that did not preserve his own objection to his own instruction. But aside from the procedural part, the wording in the instructions is just slightly different, whether it's any issue being tried in the Commonwealth or proper matter of inquiry, which was in the defendant's. And what that went to, the any issue, the proper matter, all has to do with Gray's guilt or innocence at his trial, where they were testifying. And so it's really the same... It's the same thing whether we'd said one way or the other, and so certainly the trial court did not err in not giving the defendant's instruction and in giving the Commonwealth's instruction instead. And for those reasons, I'd ask that the conviction be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Mr. Meyer?
Thank you.
You've got a little over 2 minutes.
Yes, ma'am.
Use it wisely.
Yes, ma'am. What's important here? It is my client is not held to the burden of whether or not David Gray lied. The Commonwealth had to prove my client lied, and they simply didn't do that. As Judge Attlee noted, she was never asked, was he injured at the fight? How did the bag get there? Where was the bag for the duration? None of those questions were asked, and we're stuck with inferences made upon her very limited testimony, strung through different witnesses, to say, well, she must have been lying, and we've got to use common sense. And that's just not the legal standard. And in supporting that, Donati was noted. I would like to mention that Donati held that corroboration was not an issue because this wasn't a case of competing oaths. This is a case, the case before us is a case of competing oaths. So the Donati case where the corroboration really doesn't apply here and it's distinguishable. And Fritter, that was mentioned as well, Fritter, there was found corroboration because the person that wrote the letter testified, hey, I wrote this letter. The letter itself and the detective also testified, actually, this guy gave me the letter. So there's different steps and different levels of corroboration that we have in that case. The assumption that the deal implicates my client is mislaid. She wasn't privy to it. She can't be held to it. And whether or not it's the two witness rule is well established, whether or not it's mentioned in the statute, it's been consistently applied. So again, it doesn't matter whether it's logical for Gray to do something. It doesn't matter if Gray told the truth about anything. That's irrelevant. What's relevant is whether or not my client's testimony was a lie. And She didn't testify that he fought. She didn't testify that he was hurt. She didn't testify that he couldn't get the bag. All she said is, hey, we went to the fight. The stipulation was the fight ended at 10:30. The evidence shows that the burglaries occurred well in the evening, past 10:30. And then she said 5 days or 7 days later, we got the tennis shoes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.